Thank you, Pat. We appreciate being able to join in this chapel hour with you. How many of you that are here today were here 2 years ago at the chapel service? Well, you'll meet some of the same people, but the message is not going to be exactly the same. We have some here that we did not have 2 years ago, and I'd like to call first on Margie Gould to come up here and join me. From the time that Dawson got started until about 1939, he did not have a full-time secretary. Margie, I asked Pat how many of these work over in the office, and he said about 170. So for about 2 years, Margie did for the Navigators that which has grown into all that you're doing today. So how would you like to have the workload today, at least, Marcia? So, Amos, it's a real honor just to present. We want to see several people. Marge, if you got a speech ready, I didn't ask you to prepare one, so we won't ask you. We just want everybody to see Margie Gould. And I want to ask a very embarrassing question here at this point, too. How many of you have read this book, Doss?
I'm in there.
Well, the rest of you will find a lot of great information about these folks you're going to meet today in here. So we don't have time to bring it all today. Do the follow-up in here. Thank you, Margie. And I would like to say at this point that those who are going to appear before you have just been asked to be here, and none has been given any warning about what their parts do. So when I ask them, that'll be the first clue as to how they're supposed to participate. Vivian. This is Vivian Fusby Waters. And Vivian, you became Dawson's secretary what year?
1939.
Until
45.
Until 1945. Dawson's personal secretary, and now I know that these folks are very productive, but I expect that you turned out as much work during that time as any three of them are turning out. What a privilege that Vivian's had to have been Dawson's personal secretary, and the only staff member for part of that time.
Well, Jim...
Jim Hayden, yeah. We're going to get Jim up here in just a minute. But were you he came on staff at also 1939. So there are about three of you that were carrying the work. Well, thank you very much, Vivian.
Okay.
Now I'd like to call on next the other part of the Waters family. And Ken Waters, I believe, has had a greater variety of experience with the Navigators than any of the rest of us that are here, having been a part of the ministry and leading the ministry on how many ships?
West Virginia, and then New Mex, and then Maryland.
And after that, he was on the staff of the Commander-in-Chief at IEA, Commander-in-Chief's headquarters, and one of the most productive ministries of the Navigators during all of World War II was that IEA class. And there's a large contingent of people that came out of that class that are here today. Now, Kenny, you didn't have any warning, but I think the meeting wouldn't be complete here unless we had scripture reading. And I don't have my Bible, and I don't think you have yours, so you're just going to have to do the best you can. So.
Well, there's a lot of passages we could use, but maybe the one we use this morning, which is excerpts from Hebrews. God, who at sundry times and diverse manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son. I'm not just saying this to say it. I'm saying it because it grips our hearts. Therefore, we ought to give the more earnest heed to those things which we've heard, lest by any means we should let them slip. For how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by those who heard him? Somebody start 4:1 for me. I'm blank. Hebrews 4:1. Let us therefore fear, is it? Somebody, oh, you guys out there, how does Hebrews 4:1 start? I'm tongue-tied. Stop for the first time. Let us therefore fear, lest any promise of entering into his rest, that any of us should come short of it. For the good news was preached unto us as well as unto them, but it did not profit them, because it was not mixed with faith by those who heard it. Today, if you hear his voice, harden not your hearts. By faith, Noah, when he was warned, moved with fear. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed and went out. That's all I had this morning, so that's enough. You folks scared me.
Aren't you glad? Now, you other folks that have any warning, you can get prepared here a little bit, maybe. Two things I wanted to ask you about. Where were you when the attack of Pearl Harbor began?
I was with Jim Downing and a few others up in Kalihi Valley. And I remember Jim's comment said, this can't be the Army practicing because they shoot too fast. Anyway, we jumped in the car and we went down while the second wave was coming in. And I don't know how Jim felt and some of the others, but I felt a little devastated when I saw the Arizona and bellows of smoke and the Oklahoma capsized and fire over the harbor. And there we were.
Yes, you said two things. We haven't rehearsed this, and I wonder if you remember them. I remember them. To get to our ship, which was already almost down the bottom, we had to go over to Fort Island. We went on a little boat dock, and I don't remember how we got on the ship, but I had Bible, a notebook, and you had a Bible and several notebooks. And you remember what happened then?
You told me last 2 years ago. Something about, I guess we'll need two hands?
That's what Kelly says. Well, it looks like we're going to need both hands. They were wounded to be taken care of and people we didn't know. So there was a fire extinguisher in a little wooden shack on the pier there, and we put our Bibles and notebooks, get on with both hands. And you said one other thing, too.
You have to tell me that one, but I'll tell you one other experience, but go ahead.
Okay. Kelly said, I'm glad that I'm caught up on my praying so we can go to work.
And by the way, this is another thing, but I did come up over the forecastle of the Maryland. A guy grabbed me and says, Waters, pray for me. Well, it wasn't exactly time for a prayer meeting, but what I was going to say, we were on the landing there waiting for a boat, and the Japanese had come diving down, dropping their bombs, and they came around and strafed. You know what strafing is? Letter. So, and here we had on these clean whites. Things are so embedded in you that I dropped on the ground and I held myself up so I wouldn't get my whites dirty. By midnight that night, there were one glob of oil. So I wasn't. It's just one of those instinctive things you do.
I see. Is Gordon Gustafson in the room here? Did Gordon come up? He was on the Tennessee next to us. And I had the same kind of a reaction. I was worried about my wristwatch getting full of fuel oil. You know, that everything you touched, it was up to our knees and about this deep. So I couldn't get on with it until I got off my watch and gave it to Gordon to keep from it for me until after it was over. But Jim Hayden, would you come up? Jim was Dawson Trotman's first assistant and his first male assistant. So at the time, Jim, that you and Margie worked for DOS, the three of you were the Navigator Administration. Is that right?
Right.
And how long were you with Dawson?
1939 to 1950.
And then I asked Lauren last night if he and Jim overlapped. So Lauren was the next one to come. Then there were four. So there's a little bit of overlap before Jim and his wife went on to do other things. What other things did you do while you were at the Navigators?
Oh, we did lots of Bible club work and lots of speaking, traveling. We had Navigator homes in very short periods of time in San Diego and in Long Beach. But then I was the treasurer and had to handle the money. Of course, our budget there for a year might last a day. I don't know.
Who's here from the receipting department? About how much money comes in every day? Is that a secret? Is that? $3 million a month.
We could have handled that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Jim. And is Torty here? This is Jim's wife, Torty. We're going to come back to the Foundation 4 or 5 in just a minute. But I want to call up now one of the men that was aboard one of the sister ships, the Colorado. And so, Wayne, would you come on up?
First two up here were easy. I thought we were really going to get by with it.
I'm just going to ask you two or three questions,
okay.
Wayne. Where were you serving when you became a Christian?
USS ship, Colorado.
Yes. Sister ship, West Virginia, Maryland. All three of them were similar. And Wayne has spent most of his life up to this point after getting out of the Navy with Wycliffe Translators. And just about 1 year ago, he had a very privileged experience. And that was to go into a tribe that he was the first white man who ever survived any contact with these people. And Wayne, I just want to ask you a couple of questions. How did you get up to where that tribe was located?
Dug out canoe with a Briggs and Stratton motor and a homemade tail, 5 days on the river, and then 8 hours walking upstream.
And this is in Peru, by the way, the jungles of Peru. Now, I'm really interested in what you found out about the diet of these Indians to which you went.
I think that's a loaded question. I have traveled all over Peru and know every tribe in Peru, and this is the most primitive group that we have ever met, and we just got a hold of them last July. When I traveled with them, we arrived at this house and had supper. It was a howler monkey. They're about this long, red, not too good eating. There's lots of monkey that's really delicious. And they warmed him. They do not eat cooked meat. They warmed him, and then they ate the whole monkey from the hair right on through to the intestines, leaving a few bones.
Okay, just one other question about that tribe. I think you said, Wayne, that you had brought some granola bars along.
No, I didn't. I had had a handful of granola for breakfast, and this was at 6 o'clock at night. Breakfast was at 7 o'clock in the morning. We had nothing else between.
Okay, now, God had opened their hearts to the gospel. What happened after this? Some of them were led to Christ. The next trip in, you brought somebody with you, I think you said.
Oh, no, we're a little mixed there. But after that, I sent up some other folks because of sickness. And one man who was apparently dying but lived, through one of our missionaries who could speak a native another dialect, was able to tell him that God loved him and that Jesus would save him. And that day he accepted Christ and he has lived And in that month of severe sickness where 25 did die, five of those people who had killed every person they've ever seen came to know Christ.
Okay, great. You can see what a fantastic time we've been having after most of us not having seen each other for more than 40 years, getting together and reminiscing. Thank you, Wayne.
He's not done with me yet. I'm going to tell you one thing more.
Okay.
You know, Ken Waters read the scripture this morning, and one of the most thrilling things that I ever saw among the Machiginga Indians, where we translated the New Testament and portions of the Old Testament, was sitting in a little grassroots schoolhouse one day, and this man, 50 years old, had become a Christian 2 years earlier, stood up there and had five people read a passage in John, and then he stood there and reread the whole thing and added the rest of it and preached with the closed New Testament in his hands. It's wonderful what God can do.
Roy Robertson. Roy is no stranger. Maybe on the Navigators, that whether it's a book or a brochure or a slide presentation, Roy is always in there as the Navigator's first missionary who went to China in 1949. Roy has just returned from a trip in China just 2 weeks ago, and at age 64, he led a group of 15 students on a bicycle trip all summer, and they averaged about 50 miles a day, is what he said the other day. So, Roy, what was your purpose in going into China?
Our purpose in going into China was I wanted to see it myself, and I wanted some cover. So I thought with college students, that'd be a perfect cover for an old veteran missionary like me going in, and it turned out to be that. Then also we wanted to challenge these students to go to the mission field, and we prayed that at least 50% of them would give their lives to missions as a result of this trip. And third, we wanted to lead souls to Christ.
Now, how long has it been since you'd left China till you went back this time?
I left Thanksgiving in 1950 after being under the communists for a year and a half in Shanghai.
And what was the observation after being gone? 36 years?
When we bicycled into Canton, after you got by some of the hotels or something like that, it looked like that 35 years had gone and is exactly the same as it was before. The shops, the language, the people, the way the women talk, the customs and everything, somebody had forgotten to turn the clock.
And you attribute that to, you mentioned the other day that communism is not necessarily progressive, is it?
I believe that the communists have failed to brainwash the people against God, basically. That in the scripture, of course, it says that Romans 1:19, that there's a consciousness of God in the heart of every man, because God has made him like that and showed him the presence of God. And so we're 15 people, and we went boldly to witness and use a bridge tract, and very seldom would people challenge us or things like this. They seem eager and interested to learn more about God. Not that they know a lot about him, but there was a hunger and a thirst, I believe, that exist, more so than when I was in Shanghai 36 years ago.
And how many, numbers are not that important, but did you have a response?
We had 45 people after presenting the bridge. Incidentally, I taught them a few words of Chinese, how shall she, that's the good news, and ni fan zui, your center, shang xin yesu, believe in Jesus. And they would follow the pictures. One picture's worth a thousand words. So we had a 5,000 word tract. That is, we had five pictures. And they would go through this. You start with two people. You have 10 around you and all around like this. And then we try to narrow it down to one or two. We had 45 who gave their names. We exchanged names and said, yes, I believe. Category one. We had 35 more who seemed quite interested, but we weren't quite sure of where they stood.
And all you told us the other morning about the one city where you created a riot, that I heard Anthony Zioli say that when he preached the gospel, he wanted to see a revival a riot or a revolution?
Well, we had eager people in our team, and so we kept going further and further and further in. We didn't have any guides, didn't have any white-shirted people, you know, the secret police. They either wear a white shirt or a white coat. Everybody can see them. They didn't follow us on our bicycles, of course. They're too lazy for that. So we went to villages, went further and further and further and further in, till we finally got to a place where when we tried to check in the hotel, they said, you can't check in here. You're in forbidden territory. And furthermore, we told our people not to witness, but of course they were out witnessing. So they grabbed one of the tracks and like this and say, well, tomorrow morning we're going to provide transportation for you out of our city. So we were escorted to another place, but 2 days later we're witnessing again. We lost our tail.
Yes, one other thing that interested me is I heard you tell that, and the crowds that saw the police apprehending you, which side were they on?
They were on our side. We had a doctor named Dr. Jung, and he treated several members of our team. They have touring places where their medicine, you know, they have a Red Cross. Red Cross means this is a place where you can go for medical help. So he told me, oh, these people are bad. No, they're doing a wrong thing. You're good and they're bad, he said. And he worked for the communists. He's one of their official doctors. And the people around, when they came up with a sidecar, motorcycle and a sidecar, and made their siren, so everybody parted while they came in. And then after they got in, everybody rushed, you know, to about 200 people in front of the hotel looking. And they were definitely on our side. They were very friendly to us, very courteous. They waved and all when we left under guard and smiled. And we hope to go back to the city again.
Yes, we've covered some of the humorous things here, but I'm sure what Roy is conveying behind is that there's open hearts over there for the message.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roy. John Prince. Where is John? I see him back here. Well, we'll... I thought I saw him back the back here. So we'll wait for him. Don Rosenberger. Now, this is going to be a real challenge to ask Don questions that I can get a one-sentence reply out of.
Won't be easy.
But we'll try.
Okay.
I think Don had one of the most fascinating assignments that anybody in the Navigators has ever had. And Don, a few years after you had this interesting assignment, Lauren and I was going to make a trip up to Minneapolis, and he took out a staff list and said, let's see how many of our staff came out of that ministry. And we counted 29. So he said, well, you go to the dean of the school and thank him for providing those 29 staff members. So what was that assignment?
In 1949, Dawson had communicated with Billy Graham, the president of Northwestern Schools, who had asked Doss to send someone to teach courses of navigator emphasis at Northwestern Schools in Minneapolis.
Now, did you hold formal classes in this?
We had one course in scripture memory. Would you believe that? Which was a two-hour course for one semester. We had one course in Bible study, which was for one semester, 3 credit hours. And then we had a course which was called follow-up in the catalog, which consisted of a two-semester course, 3 hours each semester.
How many students do you have per class?
Actually, the classes were very popular, and it would be difficult for me to... there were different numbers in the different classes, but I would say the average in the vicinity around 75 to 100 and a quarter.
And now, just off the top of your head, who are some of the people that are on the Navigator staff today or have been that were in those classes?
Can I correct that just a little bit to say this also? There were in Minneapolis at that time fellows who had come to Minneapolis to participate in what was more generally the Navigator ministry there, and who were active in other universities. and many of the fellows who are very active in the work today were in that category and not necessarily as students. But Waldron Scott was one of those students. Leroy Imes was one of those students in Northwestern schools. But Bob Seifert, who is the director of the Navigators in Dallas, Texas, was our contact for the University of Minnesota. Interesting thing about this, we saw several hundred young people find Christ over the period of a couple of years there. And when this began to occur like popcorn, Bob Seifert had a very unusual kind of experience. Can I take 1 minute and tell you about it? You know the verse, Matthew 4:19, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. The incredible thing was this handsome young guy who is a straight arrow, I mean to tell you, but this handsome young fellow couldn't win anything to the Lord but women. The girls were coming to Christ like this all over the place. So we revised the scripture, and Matthew 4:19a says, follow me and I'll make you fishers of women. And
do you remember one of your students named Roy Cook?
Very well.
Roy Cook was one of Don's students for a while, and I don't know what else he learned, but the one thing that seemed to really burn in his heart was, where's your man? So he didn't know anybody in Minneapolis, but he knew a man who worked in a bank back in Oregon by the name of Doug Coe. So Roy Cook dropped out of school, went back, got hold of Doug Coe, and brought him back and enrolled him. Now, Doug was probably not a Christian at that time, so he didn't last too long. So when he went back to Oregon, Roy Cook, instead of continuing, went back. Doug Coe today, after being a staff member of the Navigators many years, is no doubt the most influential Christian man in all Washington, D.C., and in many countries of the world. And it was Roy Cook to Doug.
You can see Doug Coe's picture in Chuck Colson's book, Born Again, because he was very active in the initial contacts with Chuck Colson, as well as with a number of people who have been involved in difficult times there in Washington, D.C. The National Prayer Breakfast for the President, which meets in February of each year in Washington, D.C., is a function of the activity in the ministry of which Doug Coe is the head there.
Thank you very much. The last 2 years I lived in Washington. We were neighbors of Doug the last 2 years in Washington, and I was thankful every day for that chain of circumstances. Now, I don't even have my own script here, but since we have you folks that are here, at the time Charles Colson was being sentenced to prison, I had a call one day from two girls that worked in the shipping department. That's when shipping department was down in the barn. And they said, the Lord has laid on our heart to send him some material. How do we get it to him? I said, well, I'm sure the first day he's in jail, he will be visited by Doug Coe. So I gave him Doug's address. They sent the material. As I was reading Born Again, you remember the account, he said, my first visitor was Doug Coe, and he brought with him some Navigator materials. I was sitting next to Chuck Colson at a banquet sometime one evening, and it happened there were two of us on the right. Chuck was in this position, and then three other people over here, so he couldn't talk to anybody but me during that preliminary. So after he found out I was from the Navigators, he said, I do not believe that in the book I gave the proper credit to what the Navigators have done for me. He said, those materials that Doug brought did more than anything else to build me up and to help me and sustain my Christian life while in jail. So that was all a result of the Lord laying on the hearts of two girls that worked in shipping to get those materials to him. Okay, I see John Prince is here. And Harold Lindenmeyer. Now, I'm not going to ask you guys to say anything, but I want you to come on up and stand in front here. And let's see. John, would you stand over here on the right? And Lindy on the left. You know, come in a little closer. And I'd like to know if you see any resemblance. On page, 124 in DOS, there's a picture of six sailors taken in 1937. And 37 years, how many is 37 to 7 from to date? How many years is that? 37 from 46, isn't it? This, what year is this? 55? 85? 38 years later, I just wanted you to see three of the people that were in this picture. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I'm sorry we don't have time for you to preach. Now, could we be joined up here with Les Spencer, Ed Goodrick, John Dedrick, and Virgil Hook? And I don't know how we're all going to get around here. Why don't a couple of you get up here? And
if
then
I stay down, the rest of you can get up there.
Now, some of you heard Les Spencer 2 years ago. And just two questions I want to ask you, Les. First of all, I want to see whether this is real. He's got a real right arm here. Did you actually tell Dawson Topman you would give your right arm if you could do what you would have seen him do as he witnessed to this watchman, policeman?
Yes.
And what was his response?
Well, he led me on for a while, sort of bantering me. Oh, you wouldn't do that, you know. And that went on while we walked up the driveway, comma. This is one sentence, you know, and this is the comma.
Okay. Okay, what happened next?
We got back to the car that we were riding in, and so Doss finally said, well, Les, said, you know, if you really mean business, you can do what I was doing and still keep your right arm. And I said to him, what do you have in mind? He had plenty in mind, I can tell you.
Okay, now another quotation that is attributed to you is that when you took Gurney Harris to see Dawson, you said to Dawson, well, what did you say to him?
Well, I said to Dawson when Gurney Harris came over, I said, tell this fellow what you've been telling me. And he'd been discipling me. And I had a desire to see Gurney get in on all those good things, too. And so that's what he...
He didn't say, you teach him.
Yes.
Oh, he did. Okay.
That's what he said.
Yeah. Okay, that'd be my next question. Okay, that's what you said. Now, what did he say?
He said... You teach him.
And what did you say?
And I said, well, Doss, I don't know how.
And what did he say?
He said something to the effect, he said, if you can't tell him what I told you, I failed. And furthermore, he said, I'll help you.
Okay, we're setting the record straight on those two conversations. Now, several times in this conference, these four people I've referred to as the foundational four. Actually, it was the foundational five, because Gurney Harris. To whom Les just referred, is with the Lord. Good. So we won't call you the four, but the five.
Good.
Okay, we're not in a sequence here now, but Virgil Hook, you spent how many years in Tibet?
About 10 years working among the Tibetan people.
Yes, now you had a very special privilege that enabled you to get around without the authorities interfering with you. What was that?
That was my Tibetan name.
Tell us about it. You can have a paragraph.
I have been taken from the with the head of the CNMA missionary group over to visit a head living Buddha in the monastery there. And I did a few magic tricks and played my little mouth harp for him, and he was quite pleased with me. So he asked me if I had a Tibetan name. I said, no. He said, well, how would it be if I gave you one? Fine. So he gave me the name Lobsang Drashi. Then going around, as people would ask, what's your name? I said, Lobsang Drashi. And I said, well, where'd you get a name like that? Because no Tibetan would ever give their child that name. It sort of includes like a doctor's degree along with it. And so Alek Jangyun Japa gave it to me. Oh, you know him. That sort of opens sesame then.
So if you ever given any opposition, all you had to do is to get your name.
Yeah, just let my name be known.
Who now, Virgil told us the other day that he almost had a Tibetan wife given to him. Tell us about that incident.
I'd been visiting a monastery and giving out tracts and all, and it was festival time, and at festival times only are women allowed in the monasteries. Otherwise, donkeys and women are not allowed in the monasteries. And as I was leaving, a lady and her daughter were walking along, and they talked a little bit with me, and then this lady said, are you married? I said, no. And she said, well, then you'd like to have my daughter, wouldn't you? And I said, well, you know, she was a right attractive-looking young lady. I couldn't really say no, but so I said, well, can she read? And the lady said, no, she can't read. So I said, well, I'd like to have a wife that can read.
Okay. Ed, you've read in the scripture many times. I'm not talking to Adam, talk to the rest of you, from Dan to Beersheba. What's the significance of from Dan to Beersheba?
It's the normal way of expressing the northern and southernmost limits of the Holy Land, the land of promise.
How many miles is that from Dan to Beersheba?
It's 150 miles as the crow flies.
Now, you decided a few years ago that you wanted to make the trip from Dan to Beersheba. Is that right?
That's right, I did.
And you made the trip?
And I made the trip.
And how did you make the trip?
I walked. I wanted to know what it was like to have the feel of the distances that the biblical characters had, and the only way to do that is to walk when they walked. And so I decided I'd walk from Dan to Beersheba. I wanted some of the comforts of civilization, so I had a little camping equipment and some textbooks and some photography equipment, and I couldn't carry all that, so I bought me a donkey at just above Dan on Mount Hermon. If it would have been, I planned if it was going to be a girl, it would be Beersheba, and if it was a boy, it's going to be Dan. And they showed me a lovely one that could be named Beersheba, but she was terribly pregnant, and I just couldn't conceive myself of being a midwife to a donkey somewhere out in the Netherlands. I asked if there wasn't a Dan available.
Now, was this a donkey that carried your pack and camp equipment real cooperative?
No, I think it was mainly my fault. You have to learn how to drive a donkey as much as learn how to drive a car. And I tried to get it in high gear, but I never found a slot for it. I tried and tried one time. A little boy about 10 years old saw my plight. And he got behind that donkey, and he said those magic words. And all day long, that donkey walked in high gear. And I tried to mimic his voice and tried to mimic his voice, and I couldn't fool the donkey. He knew.
What years were that you went made that trip?
That was in 67.
Well, I hope these older navigators are an inspiration. When you're 64, you go bicycling in China. When you're not that quite old, you take a hike from Dan to Beersheba. John, can we have you from the back? I've got one final question to ask each one of you here.
Okay. All right, but if I could take a vote with the others, and if Gurney were here, I don't think we would settle for the first five. I really don't. I'd settle for the first six. And I think somebody else is going to have to say this. as much as I respect John and Bernie Gurney and Les and Cook, I think as far as setting the tone of the Navigators, you've made more of a contribution than any other one of us, and that's for the record. Ed became a professor of Greek and Hebrew after serving a short time in the pastorate. I expect that many of you in this room have benefited from the complete concordance on the New International Version of the New Testament. And you'll notice that the compiler of that, Edward W. Goodrich, that you have here before you. John? A part of the Foundation 5, John Dedrick. by profession, John was a radioman. Somehow you got interested in celestial navigation. How did you get interested in celestial navigation?
No, I joined the Navy specifically. I'd investigated in the recruiting station in Houston, Texas. I lived in Weimar, which is 100 miles to the west. My dad took me in specifically because we knew when I was getting out of high school we wouldn't have funds to send me to college. We went and checked on the Navy to see what they had to offer, and we found out that they had two things to offer. One was what they called a Naval Academy Preparation Class, and they had a whole list of trade schools, electric and bugle school and music and who knows what else, and they had a radio school. But I joined the Navy. I thought I'll gamble 4 years of my life against a chance to get into this Naval Academy preparation class. That's the basic reason that I joined the Navy in June 1929. I went to Houston. Well, in fact, I went to investigate and went back home and then later joined. But I thought if worse comes to worse, radio was an oncoming thing, and that fascinated me. I thought, well, if I don't make the Naval Academy preparation class, I'll take radio school. So I went on out and joined the Navy and went through the basic training that all of us have to take, and I qualified in every respect for the Naval Academy preparation class. And they had us all up there ready, and they were... Well, the first thing they did was a physical examination, and they started our toes, toenails, you name it. I never had an examination eyelid. They weren't taking anything that was bone spavin or swayed back or you know what. And I don't know, that exam was about 3 hours, physical exam. And they worked up, and they left nothing untouched. And the last thing he looked at was my eye, and he blew his top. I'm blind in one eye. I'd fallen on a stick when I was a kid, and he said, "Blind people, how did you even get in the Navy?"
On the navigation thing
okay,
here.
Okay, that's it. We're getting right into that. Then I took radio school. We're getting right there. I took radio school, but after I got out, I thought, well, I can't make commission through the Naval Academy, but I'll work on my own and try to come up through the ranks. So I started studying navigation.
Good. And you met Dawson Trotman during that period.
That was the period I met Dawson.
Did you ever discuss with him the use of the sextant taking star sights?
Yes, I was very fascinated with navigation.
And you explained, you actually taught him how to take star sights.
What I had learned, how to take sights, how to these spherical trigonometry is what it is. It's very simple. The celestial sphere. In fact, that's what had gotten me. I actually, I became an atheist because of the study of Navajo. I could not conceive that there could be any being as tremendous as this universe when you study it even from the celestial navigation point of view, because every star is a fixed point out there that you work on. And that's a, I can explain the theory, but we don't want to go in that. Okay.
No, okay. But Dawson Troutman was fascinated. Many of these, Virgil and Lester, met Mrs. Rittenhouse in San Diego before they met Dawson Troutman, and she had what was called a Servicemen's Bible Club. So when Dawson Troutman thought that there was enough interest to attach a name to what was going on, he asked her if they could call this Servicemen's Club Number 2. But Mrs. Rittenhouse, I think, did not have that much confidence in how
it was. Dawson, Milo Jameson had his radio Bible class, and that was what they didn't want. They weren't anxious for him to use this Bible class idea. Milo Jameson, if I'm not mistaken.
You're right, John.
It was Milo Jameson.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't Mother Rittenhouse. No.
Yeah, all right.
Okay,
now,
set the
but,
record.
But got the record straight.
Huh? Okay.
But Dawson Troutman was looking for a name. And as he talked with John and saw what celestial navigation is all about, moving from one place to the other.
Find a new way.
Yeah, it occurred to him, you know, this is what everybody's doing. And without a chart and a guide and a section and everything, you never make it. So it was out of Dawson Troutman's conversations with John Dedrick that the name Navigators came into being.
We now, didn't know then.
Yeah. John, you have spent how many years of your life in Mexico?
Well, I spent actually 37 there.
And your tribe is?
The Yaqui Indian tribe, northwestern Mexico.
How many people in the tribe?
Between 15,000 and 20,000.
And how many of them are Christians today?
I'd like to know. I don't know. It's a very difficult. It'd take hours to orient you. I can't go into it. We've done the New Testament. We're working. We worked until 1937 to get the New Testament done so that we could begin work. I mean, 1987. Oh, boy, how about we worked 37 years to get the New Testament done so that we could begin work. And just within a few days, we had almost no opposition from any quarter until the New Testament was practically done. Now there are 8 sects trying to work with the Yaquis. And that includes Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, and they are divisive, competitive, and they are sowing pure confusion, plus the fact that we're getting unbelievable competition from, or I should say opposition, from radical Marxists.
Okay, well, our time is about up. I figured out how much this hour is going to cost in the payroll. And estimate to be about $2,000 worth of time that we've used here, so we need to bring it to a close. But I want to ask each one of these men up here just one question of the Navigator basics. That is, let's say there's 4 points in the wheel. We won't talk about the Christ-centeredness, but the Word, prayer, witnessing, and fellowship. Which one of those, and in the Word we include memory, of those basics has been the most vital to you in these last 45 years? Ed?
I'd have to say from the top of my head the Word.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Same. I hate to separate them, but if you have to say, I'd hate to even draw the line. But yes, Scripture. When God talks, that's it.
Okay.
I agree.
I too. I'd say the Word.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Our time is up. We really appreciate being with you.